The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
I think they're blind. I think they're blind with rage to seeing that they are, in fact, misdiagnosing cause, and the source of excess within the system is being driven by an unelected source. But they can't bring themselves to acknowledge that it is, in fact, the seen hand of unelected technocratic power which bears responsibility for creating this monster. It's not the unseen hand of the market.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. We've talked in the past, Dave, about how deliberate your parents were, and especially you and your wife now, with your kids. Consequences seem to be an important part. I mean, loving your children is first, but consequences, they have to understand that there's a cause and effect. It's almost like free markets.
Well, and not to get too philosophical, but the idea of agency and the idea of an individual making choices, the importance of those choices is that there are consequences to our choices.
Right.
So to be able
both
to-
both good and bad.
Yeah, and to line out what are the logical consequences, the good logical or the bad logical consequences, it really what it does is it makes someone reflect and say, this is my life, my destiny. This is, I can make a mess of this, or I can make something really neat from this.
Well, and one of the greatest ways you can show love to your children is to display that there are consequences and encourage good decisions. You know, I think about what we're seeing in the markets now. We've called them free markets in the past, but it's hardly free when governments intervene and they don't allow companies to fail. They really don't suffer the consequences of bad behavior. In fact, companies these days don't really even have to have a profit to be rewarded.
Well, what's fascinating to me is if you look at the Chinese exchange, Chinext, they just changed their requirements for listing as a publicly traded company. And so with so many profitless companies listing in the United States and on other exchanges, you had Shenzhen's technology-focused Chinex exchange. They want to compete. So what do they have to do to compete in a world of profitless companies? You lower the bar to do so. So you can now list through Chinex. Chinex is a little bit like New York's NASDAQ. Again, technology focused. But up until now, both Shanghai and Shenzhen, their stock exchanges, have had a multi-year, 2 to 3 year profitability requirement prior to going public.
Well, doesn't that make sense? I mean, if you're going to go public, shouldn't you be making some money first?
There's a sense in which that's intuitive. Or yes, it makes sense. Yes, to me it does. But the Chinese Securities Regulatory Commission announced that the profitability requirements were going to be scrapped for Chinex IPOs. And they're hoping that that brings liquidity to fledgling companies in need of an infusion to move ahead. And so that's not all bad. But what you do see is like what we have in the United States, many of the unicorns which have gone public in the last year or so, they're high-risk propositions because it's not like they have revenue and sales already in tow. They're ideas. And as long as the ideas become something, as long as the dream becomes reality, that's fine. But an investor is speculating on a dream, not on a functional operation. So that's really where the Chinese have to this point basically said, great, if you're a functional operation, you have profits, then we'll list you. And now they're saying, well, we're missing out on a lot of listings. And this is not Chinext as an example. But Alibaba came to the New York Stock Exchange for listing, raised $25 billion. You can imagine the fees associated with that. And it's NYSE that benefits, New York Stock Exchange that benefits. Would Shanghai have loved that? Absolutely. So they're realizing that unless they are more aggressive, they're losing out.
Well, and I wonder about that being more aggressive because the Chinese government themselves has been known to intervene in companies and keep them from failing. But I think they're changing that right now. They're starting to say, why? Why don't we let companies fail?
That's a fascinating sort of, it happens to be a coincidence in terms of time. Maybe it's not a coincidence, but you've got the Wall Street Journal this last week talking about Chinese government moving to a new mode of operation. And it is basically let companies fail, where creditors up to this point have expected the state to step in to absorb losses. And for the entities making investors were going to be made as whole as possible in that process.
And that was through interventions, government interventions.
Yep. But that's not so going forward. So if fascinating, you've got now you have 90 bankruptcy courts that have been created to deal with corporate defaults. rather than, you know, the old mode of operation, which was state banks just kind of sweeping everything in and being forced to act and absorbing those assets. And so what it recalls for me, go back to 2005, six, I think that was about the time that Sheila Bair came in as chief of the FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corp, you know, overseeing sort of the interventionist possibilities within our U.S. banking system. And 2006, 2007, she started staffing up, increasing staffing at the FDIC.
Strangely preparing for something we later saw what she was staffing up for.
Before we saw banks under pressure, and it's not everybody. It's not everybody that is blind to the potential unwind. And Sheila certainly was not, and I think you have examples of, you know, not taking everyone by surprise. The idea of a black swan is kind of a misnomer to some degree if you're going back to the mortgage-backed securities market and what was deteriorating in that time frame. There you have Sheila Bair gearing up, staffing up for what she assumed was going to be a crisis. And you see the same thing in China. 90 bankruptcy courts to deal with corporate defaults. What are they getting in front of exactly?
They're getting ready for logical consequences is what they're getting ready for. I mean, we talked about that to start with. And, you know, I like that, Dave. In a way, wouldn't it be a breath of fresh air if the free markets were allowed to be the free markets? And we actually did see some creative destruction. I mean, who was it that talked about creative destruction? It was
Joseph. Joseph Schumpeter.
And that's good. That's how you get growth. You remember when we had Sedlacek on? And Sedlacek talked about the economics of good and evil. And he likened the interventionist type of central banking to a new form of religion, and the central bankers being the high priests of that religion, a religion of continual growth without the natural shrinkage that you need sometimes to grow further.
Kevin, we read a lot for the commentary, and I have to say that one of the most impactful books I've read in my adult life that pertains to economics and finance is Sedlacek's The Economics of Good and Evil.
It was
he
amazing.
Was the economic advisor to Václav Havel in the Czech Republic.
During the transition from communism to some form of free marketism.
That's right. So you've got the chief economic advisor to this fledgling and free country, and he's 23 years old at the time. Polymath, brilliant. And his objective in writing The Economics of Good and Evil, it's a fairly ambitious book and project, the idea that he's encapsulating there. But if you're interested at all in kind of knowing the history of money and the ideas that relate to economics and finance, GDP growth and things like that, I think you have to read it. I think you have to read it. You have to study it, and you don't have to agree with it, but it will cause you to think very differently about the issues than you've ever thought before.
Down the road, Dave, I'd like to discuss more the replacement of what used to be the church's impact on economics. That was an unelected power, and being replaced now with the central bankers, sort of a new kind of religion. And it was Sedlacek who really pointed that out to us.
The religion of growth certainly is one that's overseen by the priesthood of central bankers.
Okay, so this stock up of 90 bankruptcy courts in China, could it be because we're starting to see a slowdown, and the natural consequence or the logical consequence of a slowdown in China will be increased bankruptcy?
Yeah, official numbers are different than actual numbers, and we've said that before. So you see official numbers declining to about the 6% growth rate. And as we've talked to Michael Pettis and others who are on the ground in China, the reality is it's probably more like 2% and declining quickly. So we'll get to a negative number, and officially it'll be very beautiful, relatively speaking. But I think what we are seeing, you know, the indications, whether it's energy usage or vehicle sales have declined 16 out of the last 17 months in China. They're down 6% from last year at this time. And, you know, coming back around to the Chinex decision, let's just say that late cycle dynamics in the financial world are typified by a lowering of the bar, which by default, no pun intended, raises the implicit and the systemic risks that are in play. So in the credit markets, you've got worse credit, you've got longer durations, and incongruously as things are deteriorating, lower rates, which would ordinarily indicate lower risk. But in fact, this is where the central banks have been sort of hiding the signals. Longer durations, worse credit should imply higher interest rates, and it's not gone that way so far, although the free markets may end up determining that it goes there in the end. In the equity markets, it's, you know, shares the structure of equity shares where you have different voting rights. A shares have voting rights, B shares don't. So the controlling interests get to determine the direction of the company, and you as an investor have no say. Or things like mass dilution. Those are things that are on display. Or, you know, again, established profitability. Now you don't have to be profitable in China to get a listing. All you have to have is sort of pro forma expectations, which is what our unicorns have been doing here. They've been bottling up dreams to sell.
Right.
And that's what has been very effective. Like, you can own this 6 ounces of liquid dream a lot.
It's like snake oil. Right now, in 1999, we had that same type of thing happening with this incredible bubble that we now call the tech stock bubble that really popped. I mean, it doesn't exist anymore. You know, this morning though, okay, I was with a friend of mine who is a manufacturer, does most of his manufacturing in Asia. He sells exercise equipment, and he was called. He's leaving tomorrow for Asia. He usually goes over there for about 6 weeks, comes back for 4 to 6 weeks, and he goes back. But he was called and they said, do not come to Hong Kong. Hong Kong is too dangerous at this point for him to come to. So I thought it was interesting because this is a man that for 25 years, he's half in Asia, half here. And the Hong Kong situation, the state is now becoming something that's also worth looking at.
Now, what's funny is I talked to an economist who was previously with the IMF just a few weeks ago, and he lives in Hong Kong, but we met in New York, and he said, actually, a lot of it in Hong Kong is overblown. Mm. There's certain neighborhoods you wouldn't want to show up in because there's a lot of activity, but it's not as bad as the media has portrayed it. Now, who knows? In the last 2 weeks, maybe things have really gotten to, you know, that place.
Well, someone got lit on fire yesterday. I don't know if you saw that in the news, but I mean, someone's been shot. Someone was basically lit on fire. So I don't know whether this gentleman's going to go to Hong Kong or not. But
see, we still think about, you know, taking vacations to Mexico, and you've got drug violence that last year took 35,000 people. I mean, this is 35,000 homicides in Mexico last year, and they're supposed to beat that record. That was an all-time record. They're supposed to beat that record in 2019. So, I mean, again, all these things are relative. Yes, one man on fire. Yes, one man shot. One man tripped off the edge or pushed off the edge of a balcony or whatnot, fell to his death. I'm not minimizing this by any stretch, but lest we think that this is total carnage, all we have to do is go south of the border for, you know, 35,000 drug-related homicides. Woo. Well, so, but China, back to China, the financial pressure builds in China, right? And the fear of the state gets put on display in more obvious ways. Last week, you had a number of bank runs. 9 people were arrested for inappropriate remarks on social media. And these are comments about a local lender, like they're in deep financial crisis.
Just a warning about, you know, it's like what we do with banks.
Right.
We'll do bank ratings here and say, hey, this one's in trouble.
Yeah, but if I posted something like, you know, and again, imagine being arrested for posting on social media something like, you know, institution ABC or YYB is running into trouble. That's all I have to say. And all of a sudden, I'm being arrested for a comment. We, frankly, have no imagination for the types of controls that exist within a totalitarian state. And while we can reflect on some sort of degradation of free speech or whatnot here in the United States or in the West, we still have our frame of reference is just, it's kind of silly.
One of the things that we use as a guide to see if we're getting a little too proud, a little too much hubris, is we watch the skyline. You can see buildings being built, and the taller the building, usually the tallest ones are built right before a crash. I mean, we've seen that in the past. We see sometimes the very biggest deals done as far as takeovers. And I remember the IPOs, like I said, 20 years ago, the tech stock bubble. We were really reaching a peak of pride and hubris right before. You mentioned the NASDAQ a little bit earlier. NASDAQ was over 5,000 points 20 years ago, and it slopped down into the low 2000s, and it stayed there for, what, over a decade.
When you look at these kinds of peaks, whether it's stock market peaks or real estate market peaks, we have the same thing, I think, on display today with private equity. We talked a little bit about private equity a few weeks ago, coming back from the Grants Conference. And peak private equity is probably best captured by the deal being proposed by KKR, Colbert, Kravis, and Roberts.
We've heard that name now for decades as well.
Huge private equity group, and they're coordinating a deal for Walgreens. Hmm. And it's like the largest skyscraper, marking a peak in enthusiasm in real estate. You know, your ambitions grow, the size and scale of the project grows. Well, so too, the big deals in private equity are often done with great enthusiasm in and around your cyclical peak. So the last real estate cycle, it was the Burj Khalifa in Dubai as the largest building built, and it still is the largest building in the world.
I remember seeing that building on a Mission Impossible. I mean, now you've been there, you've seen the building live, but I can tell you, looking down in the movie, it's one of those things that it's incredibly high.
Well, so that was the phenom of the 2005 to 2009 period. Now it's the Jeddah Tower, and that's in Saudi Arabia, but it's the construction started a few years ago, and it's estimated completion. It's kind of...
How tall is that going to be?
Between 1,000 and 1,300 meters. They haven't been very specific because there's another tower that's going up also in Saudi Arabia that's going to be roughly 1,000 to 1,300 meters. So I think they want to give themselves some latitude. But the Jeddah Tower, estimated completion 2023, could have been completed sooner, but there's been some unforeseen delays. These kinds of things get built when ambitions are unbound, and ambitions are unbound when your money is unhinged, and your money is unhinged when the cost of capital is set to zero. So that's where we live, and that's what we're saying. There is a bit of irony with the largest investor here in the Jeddah Tower being the Bin Laden Group. before that blows your mind or distracts you too much, what it really is with these buildings are symbols of hubris.
Right.
They're signs of excess. And to me, they're like road markers telling you where you're at on an extraordinary credit journey.
Well, and even if we go back to the Bible, I mean, Genesis 11 talks about a tower of hubris, a tower of pride. And so this is deep within our psyche as far as understanding that there's a point where when you become a tower builder, and we all are to a degree, when you become a tower builder and you start seeing the new tall ones, look out below.
And Sedlacek really put some insight on the nature of a city and who we become in the context of city life. If you get a chance to read Sedlacek's book, I would. But, you know, this $70 billion deal proposed by KKR is the largest ever. It's the largest ever private equity deal. It dwarfs the $45 billion deal done with the energy company TXU. And KKR was the lead, and they did it as a partnership with TPG, the Texas Pacific Group. And these are some of the smartest guys in finance.
Yeah, but Walgreens, $70 billion? Walgreens?
Yeah, well, there was a merger between Alliance Boots and Walgreens not long ago. So they're still smaller than CVS, but they're number two. So Steven Schwarzman, who's at Blackstone, thought that this deal in particular would be difficult to raise more than $20 billion in equity.
Well, and I agree. I mean, it sounds to me like that's more reasonable.
Alibaba got 25. Could you raise $20 billion in equity for the Walgreens deal? What that means is, if they're talking about a $70 billion deal, you're leaving it to the debt markets to fund the remainder. Hmm. I mean, and does that surprise you? Again, we've got ultra low.
Yeah, money's free right now. Ultra low rates. I mean, zero rates,
it
right?
Attempts the finance guys to do more, go bigger, because after central bankers have crunched the numbers down, that is, almost any deal will work. And it doesn't matter if it's marginal, doesn't matter if it's profitable. Almost any deal works if you can crunch the numbers on the debt side low enough. And that's not to say that you're left with a viable entity, but the numbers work when the interest component is suppressed below a natural level where really interest should be a reflection of that balance between risk and reward. So the deal's not done. It's just been proposed, but this would include management. It would provide, fascinatingly enough, a potential exit for the CEO who has a 16% stake in the Walgreens Alliance Boots company.
Boy, that's a payday.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That's a huge payday. But you know what? It's interesting because when you buy a house, when you take a mortgage out on a house, the bank that actually does that loan owns that mortgage for maybe 30 seconds. They usually repackage it, send it on, and put it in, you know, pension funds, things like that. I would imagine this $50 billion in excess debt that would come from this would be packaged and put in people's pension funds. And then no longer do the big guys have to worry about how viable it is.
Right. Now, again, we talked about extending durations as a consequence of a late cycle dynamic. We talked about a compromise in debt quality. You've got high yield debt, which, you know, if you're talking double B, single B, you're still in a 3.9 to 4% range in terms of interest. Pretty low interest for junk bonds.
Right. These are bonds that if somebody sneezed would drop into junk category or even default category.
Those are junk categories in themselves. The last level of investment grade is triple B. But what could go wrong? What could go wrong when you're adding $50 billion in debt to a balance sheet? And, you know, pragmatically, positively thinking, probably nothing. And yet you go back to that TXU buyout, which Texas Pacific Group and KKR were involved with back in 2007. They inked the deal in 2007. And there was, as you might recall, a lot of enthusiasm about the commodities market at that time. Most commodities reached a cycle peak in 2008. So you inked the deal in 2007. Cycle peak for commodities is 2008. That's relevant because TXU was energy. And well, there you have it. They're a bankrupt company by 2014. So $8 billion in equity wiped out. And the smartest guys in finance still can't seem to recall that the cycle prevails.
Okay, but that's commodities. A person might say, well, this is Walgreens. I mean, this is drugs. This is, people are going to need this from this point forward.
Yeah. You're right. Energy prices tend to be very cyclical. So you've got the ebbs and flows, which are perhaps more dramatic. But isn't every business that way to some degree, where for a variety of reasons, earnings are volatile and the price of the shares in the company are volatile? And I think even more so today, as you've got innovations in technology, which have been transformative to not only production processes, but delivery of those products, so distribution. So just because you are the, in the case of Walgreens, the second largest purveyor of hemorrhoid cream and pharmaceuticals behind CVS, you may have margins disrupted by an organization that doesn't need those thousands of brick and mortar stores. What I'm saying is there's an evolution in play, and you may find that you are, in fact, putting together a deal that is at a cycle peak.
And I wonder, though, I mean, is that type of industry recession-proof? How did they do the last time?
Yeah, I mean, you can argue it's demographically well-supported, but look at the charts of your healthcare giants, and lo and behold, you'll find 35 to 50% declines in those stocks are not uncommon. So it suggests to me, again, that the cycle prevails. But what does it feel like to go into a down cycle carrying multiples of the debt you previously had? The smartest guys in finance are not bothered by that. And so their view is neither should you be.
Well, and we talked a couple of weeks ago about how these low-grade bonds right now are the only bonds that pay interest. You were talking earlier about junk bonds, but even the bonds that aren't junk, literally, if any kind of blip in the economy occurs, they could drop to junk status. The problem is we're not talking about a few hundred million here. We're talking, I mean, the $400 million that were talking about to Bear Stearns back in 2007.
The investment grade market.
We're talking billions.
The investment grade market is $8 trillion. That's a very large market. The investment grade bond market is ginormous. And so this is what we were talking about a few weeks ago. So as I said, you've got an $8 trillion market. Walgreens is already triple B. Right. So they're the last rung of investment grade. Or if I said that differently, they're one notch above junk, as is before they take on an extra $50 billion in debt. So play this out hypothetically. Play this out hypothetically. The deal's done. By a miracle, Walgreens remains triple B rated. So they're still investment grade, very wide demand for that. But then they hit a small speed bump and earnings decrease. All of a sudden, debt gets shifted from investment grade to junk status, or maybe your bondholder in that sense is also the bag holder.
Well, and we're also at very, very low rates. What if interest rates actually were to rise some?
Rising interest costs in the future make debt service more difficult. I know it's a leap. I know this is just hypothetical. I know it's just a thought experiment.
Sure, because interest rates don't ever go up anymore. Right?
But could you? Could you foresee a day where the largest debt deals done in modern finance are standing like towers on the horizon?
Right.
And as they stand on the horizon line, they remind and they mark out the storyline and the history of this credit bubble.
Well, and you know, we've also talked about the insiders, watching what the insiders do. And you know, I was talking about a movie before, Mission Impossible, but you remember on the Titanic, the mice, when they know a ship is going to sink, they run the direction that the ship isn't sinking. You know, it's a good way of knowing. But CEOs, it's the same type of thing.
Yeah.
If you watch what CEOs are doing during these times, they seal the deal and then they cash out.
I think you meant the rats, not the mice. We're talking about CEOs, or are we talking about the vermin on the boats? Anyways, CEOs are departing. And what does it say? I knew a man that rose through the ranks of Bristol Myers Squibb as internal legal counsel all the way to CEO. And he was a good CEO, but not all that was done while he was CEO was good. And I've always noted the departure date. And he knew the company inside and out. From a legal perspective, from every angle, he was very well studied. He'd spent 30, 40 years with the company. And so the share price tops out at around $70, roughly, plus minus a few bucks. And then it drops to the low 20s. And, you know, it took 16 years for the shares of Bristol Myers Squibb to recover.
But he got out near the high, not the low.
Yeah. So what did Charles know at his departure? Did it make sense to cash in? And for a company that he had been a part of, from basically single digit share price, why would you jump out when, you know, who knows, maybe you go to $150 a share, maybe you, but, you know, certainly the fact that Bush gave him an ambassadorship was nice. That's a nice way to
Well, he wanted to go into politics. That's the only reason he sold his shares, was he wanted to go into politics.
And not exactly. But to me, it meant something, and it's always meant something to me when CEOs are on their way out.
Right.
Better times are not directly ahead. And in fact, it was only a few years later that for Bristol Myers Squibb, the company was being prosecuted for inflating earnings and channel stuffing to the tune of about $2.5 billion. And that was between 1999 and 2001. So shareholders were actually the bag holders. We talked about bondholders being bag holders potentially with the Walgreens deal. Well, Bristol Myers shareholders were made whole a little bit. The company was required to set aside $800 million, two tranches, $500 million, and another $300 million for restitution to shareholders for, again, inflated earnings and things of that nature. So what was fascinating to me in that whole saga, and this is really weird, Bristol Myers agreed, this was a part of the settlement agreement. They had to endow a chair in business ethics and corporate governance at Seton Hall University School of Law there in Newark, New Jersey. And I thought, shouldn't you be like a paragon of ethical virtue if you're going to endow a chair? I mean, or because it, certainly they'll be remembered for what they gave, not for what they did and why they had to give.
History is written by the winners. History is written by the winners.
So that was a part of the prosecution agreement. It was really kind of nifty. But I want to be clear, Charlie and his family are great people. And they were not implicated in the prosecution. But the point is his departure meant something.
You know, when I first started with this company, you know, with your dad, it was 1987. Stock market was hitting all-time highs. Reagan was in office. Everything seemed fine. And Volcker, who had been head of the Federal Reserve, a very successful head, stepped down. And Greenspan came in just months before the largest stock market crash since 1929. Okay, your dad was calling that, but I thought it was interesting too. Greenspan stayed in for an awfully long time. And right before we had the 2007-08 crisis, Greenspan stepped down and Bernanke took over. So it's a little, to me, it's always been like that CEO departure thing. It's like, what do they know? Do they want to be credited with the gains, or do they want to be there for the losses?
Well, it's on my mind because you've got insider selling at the same time, you've got astronomically high share buybacks by these corporate titans. And that in itself is sort of a contradiction.
So using company money to buy back shares while the CEO sells his own.
That's right. So and, you know, you watch what an insider does, and that's more critical than listening to, say, a CNBC interview with that same insider, listening to what the insider says. Watch what they do, not what they say. In fairness to CNBC, on November 6th, they reported that you've got a record-setting pace for exits this year by the heads of U.S. businesses. And you might argue, we just put in all-time highs. You know, just shut up and get out there and dance and enjoy the markets. The music's playing. If the music's playing, you get out and dance.
And never mind the rats running off the boat.
Well, and right. This is the key. I mean, CNBC reported October of this year marked the highest month on record with 172 chief executives leaving their posts.
So that's a record number?
Yeah. And according to Challenger Gray and Christmas, who tracks these things, CEO departures have hit a record for the year through October with 1,332 U.S.-based companies announcing CEO departures.
What do they know?
Right. So this is not during, not even after the global financial crisis. Has there been any year with this many departures? You know, once gone, of course, there's greater latitude to liquidate company shares, the stock benefits that you received. Not that insider selling has been marginal or slight by any means, but wholesale liquidations can be implemented in earnest. And these are not your startup folks. There are a few of those, but these are your veterans in the business. A few weeks ago, we talked about how the average to be a quote unquote veteran CEO now is only about 5 years.
Right.
But again, we've created an incentive structure, and there's a problem in terms of remuneration and governance within companies where you do allow for somebody to come in, basically clean up, grab some stock options, hit the door, liquidate, have made a fortune, and then be in line to do it again with another. Just build your CEO resume, move on to the next company and do the same thing.
And then maybe go into politics, whatever. But, you know, okay, so the technology companies especially, I mean, a lot of these guys who've made it in technology are exiting at this point.
Well, we talked about that in the fourth quarter. We said a month and a half, 2-3 months ago, we said that fourth quarter selling was going to be pretty extreme because we had a number of IPOs in the middle of the year, and your 6-month lockup would be coming around.
Okay, well, let's go into that, because one of the reasons you would leave as a CEO is because you are locked up. A lot of times when you go IPO, what have you, you have to hold those shares a certain amount of time. And like you said, there's greater latitude if you leave to sell those shares, but then also right after a lockup, you don't have to leave.
Right. Well, and there's kind of a confusing piece with Uber, for example, because you've got Travis Kalanick, who is the ex-CEO of Uber, and, you know, ex-CEO because he got into trouble for a variety of things and was let go, but he was still in that lockup period. And he just got to the end of the lockup period last week. Lo and behold, you know, no surprises. We thought it would happen. He sold a few shares of Uber, about $500 million
that's
worth.
$500 million of Uber. Yeah, that's not a vote of confidence, that's even though he's still a shareholder to a degree.
Uber Alles. Well, yeah. So he ditched a few shares earlier, sold a partial share to SoftBank and gathered in about $1.4 billion. That was, of course, closer to the IPO price of $45. Last week's sales were about half the price. So yeah, since IPO, shares are not doing that great with Uber. But yes, he still holds some shares at 5% of the company, even after that last liquidation. I guess what this illustrates is that there is a proliferation of public vehicles for private gain. And whether it is private equity or chief executives playing the game, getting the stock options, cashing them out upon departure, and the general public being clueless as to how these games are played, here's where I am very concerned. This is why this even matters. Other than being fascinated by market dynamics, I fear the wrath of the masses when they wake up, when they look at stripped pension plans and empty 401k retirement programs, and then start playing the blame game in the context of some election,
right,
where a progressive sits and is waiting there to capitalize on the angst and frustration of the moment and is there to offer promises of, you know, something for nothing. Or, you know, frankly, if they're answering to the mob, better yet for the angry mob, something at the expense of someone else.
Right. Well, we talked about bag holders. You know, when people find out that their pension fund was the actual bag holder, when somebody says, well, you're going to retire in 2030, so we're going to invest your money in a 2030 retirement type of plan. You have absolutely no idea what's in that until you get to that point.
Take your standard pension funds today. In the last 3 years, you know what they've done? They've gone from an average allocation in equities of 44% to just shy of 48%. So they're increasing risk within their portfolios. And then that's just with equities. They're doing the same thing with credit quality, extending duration, lower quality, increasing as much, grabbing as much yield as they can. I mean, you've got pensions who are buying 100-year Argentinian bonds last year like idiots.
Right. Yeah. They're also buying shares from these corporate executives who are getting out and running off the boat.
So, you know, again, what bothers me is there is the social justice meme, which has and will continue to find many expressions, where you have sort of the majority, that is a democracy, the majority, ganging up on a minority, as long as there's sort of a Robin Hood spirit to it, it's totally acceptable in today's context. And again, as long as money is involved, then and the Robin Hood spirit's in motion, then it just makes sense.
It's interesting to me who actually is jumping on that bandwagon. I mean, people at this point are starting to, people you would not expect, economists are going, you know, maybe there is something to this redistribution thing.
Well, it's a baring of teeth. It's not like a dog doesn't have sharp canines, but you don't really notice them until the teeth are bared. And I felt like this last week as I was reading a number of PhD economists, whether it was Stiglitz or Eichengreen or Krugman, they're all sort of shedding civility. And the moderate language is being dropped, and it's just more obviously redistribution-based. And there's an indictment of the market economy, an indictment of everything relating to free trade, an indictment of, yeah, there was kind of one unqualified Stiglitz quote for the week, and I think this is kind of the example, and it suffices. He says, the credibility of neoliberalism's faith in unfettered markets as the surest road to shared prosperity is on life support these days, and well, it should be. The simultaneous waning of confidence in neoliberalism and in democracy is no coincidence or mere correlation. Neoliberalism has undermined democracy for 40 years.
Well, and just to be clear, what he's using is neoliberalism would be what we would call free market conservatism.
Or
I mean,
some,
it's changed a little bit,
yeah,
but neoliberalism, that's in the European context.
Exactly. Neo, the newer version of liberalism. And liberalism, we're talking about classical liberalism, which harkens back to Edmund Burke and Benjamin Constant. And,
yeah, we're not talking about progressives.
No. This is not liberal as in the same thing as left and conservative on the right. Liberalism in the classic sense of liberalism was very quote unquote conservative. And he's saying basically the free market inclinations of that conservative philosophy are destroying democracy. Can't you see it? And again, neoliberalism is the philosophy he believes underpins laissez-faire, free market dynamics. What I think he's doing is he's pinning the tail on the wrong donkey.
Right, because we don't have free markets anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a critique or reflection on the corruption of capitalism in what is actually happening, the control of the business cycle, and that's being attempted through monetary and fiscal policies. And these are not exactly expressions of quote-unquote neoliberalism, which is what he's describing. I think the failure within the financial markets and the excesses that we see within the financial markets, even the disparity between rich and poor, is growing out of the tendency to control the business cycle, the tendency to corrupt capitalism by an infusion of liquidity and credit that is, yeah, again, it's inappropriate.
Well, and we started the program talking about logical consequences, and you leave a system like a market economy alone, and it's amazing where it can go. But we've taken the logical consequences away, and actually, you know, you were talking about neoliberalism and this redistribution, laissez-faire. The thing is, we no longer can talk about anything without categorizing it. These guys are talking about how market economy no longer works. But if you think about the polarization, Dave, there's really only two camps anymore. I was having a discussion with a gentleman at the restaurant that you and I meet at last night, and he's a very intelligent guy. He's a thinker. But the problem is, I can tell, he's having a hard time distinguishing a Trump in the White House, an economy that's free market, his pension that's shrinking. Go right on down the list, and he's got a basket, and it's all one thing. And the problem is, we don't have free markets anymore. So how in the world can we blame them and then accept socialism as the other answer?
Well, that's right. So it's not actually capitalism that is failing here. It's a bastardization of capitalism, which is failing. And, you know, while I've highlighted issues of concern, what we talked about today in terms of the market economy, I have no problem with a free market economy,
right?
There are specific issues that must be addressed in terms of corporate governance, in terms of compensation, in terms of the corruption of capitalism via the controlled and manipulated functions of central bank monetary policy, specifically the attempts to determine market pricing by whim within the debt markets, setting them at an unnatural rate. The problem is not the free markets. It's the liberties taken within the free markets that have lacked sufficient accountability and oversight and consequence, right? So, and this is where I think, in all fairness to the crowd that is entirely laissez-faire, the markets are not self-regulating. They are not self-regulating. And the problem is because if you look in the mirror, and if I look in the mirror, just as G.K. Chesterton did years ago when he wrote his book, What is Wrong with the World? And he said, I am. He started the book by saying, I am, yours truly, G.K. Chesterton. We are what's wrong with the world. And what I'm saying is that we cannot assume that taking imperfect agents into a system is going to make for perfect decision making, right? There has to be, there is a role for regulation, but there's not a role, in my view, for absolute top-down management and control. The technocracy, which is becoming more common in Europe, has long been common in Europe and is becoming more common in the United States, is not, I think, ultimately healthy. So again, the problem is not the free markets, it's the liberties taken within the free markets. You bring in accountability, oversight, and consequence, and we have basically done that. We forestalled logical consequences to the benefit of a few, and the many are getting angry. The problem is with the interventions, not with the system itself.
Right, the interventions are being done by the unelected, okay? As far as these unelected powerful people, like central banks, they come in, they intervene, and so you really don't have the free market system. You talk about the free markets not being self-regulating. You're correct. I mean, one of the great weaknesses of the free markets is that monopolies form and then completely crush everyone else. You know, the Amazon type of thing where everybody just starts going out of business. So you do have to have regulation. I think to Smithers, okay, Andrew Smithers, he said, wait a second, guys. You're really going to let CEOs sell their own shares at the same time that they buy back with company money the shares. There's something wrong with that. So yes, regulation needs to come in to some degree.
And there's issues that deserve critique and modification, but that's different. That's different than saying the system is broken and needs to be thrown out, as many progressive academics are suggesting. And the tone amongst those academics has changed in the Trump era. Again, the teeth are bared, and there's almost a weather underground desperation being expressed amongst the left-leaning academics. And, you know, while they go about prescribing solutions to the ills of our day, I think they're blind. I think they're blind with rage to seeing that they are, in fact, misdiagnosing cause, and the source of excess within the system is, as you described, it's being driven by an unelected source, right?
Yeah.
They want to deal radically with the system because of symptoms of unhealth that are observable. But they can't bring themselves to acknowledge that it is, in fact, the seen hand of unelected technocratic power, which bears responsibility for creating this monster. It's not the unseen hand of the market.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.